This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is Diana West, columnist for the Washington Examiner. Her blog can be found online at dianawest.net, and her latest book is The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. One of the ideas during this war on terror that has seemed to have pretty much universal support is that the U.S. following 9/11 needed to be in Afghanistan, and until the job is finished there, we need to stay. That's certainly been the policy of the Bush and now Obama administrations. However, there is a growing challenge to that conventional wisdom, and that's what Diana talks about in her latest blog entry on Tuesday. And Diana, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Greg.
You believe it's time to get out of Afghanistan. Why?
Yes, I do. And this is something, actually, it's not my latest column for the Examiner. It's something I wrote back in April. So this is something I've been thinking about for a while, but my latest writings of it at my blog were prompted by George Will's column today, which, of course, rather famously is calling for us to depart Afghanistan. I believe that our policy in the war on terror is based on a serious fallacy, and that fallacy is that an infidel nation like the United States, and I mean that by infidel, I mean a non-Islamic nation, cannot fight for the soul of an Islamic nation, which essentially is what nation building, what working for hearts and minds, what working to secure populations, which are our strategies in both Iraq and Afghanistan, are based on. We fail to acknowledge the completely diametrical opposition contained within Islam and the West, in the belief systems of Islam and the West. And I think this is due to political correctness and a host of not quite courageous attitudes in our elites not to confront realities of history and religion and culture. And this has led us to a very dangerous situation and led us to involvements in these wars, which, as George Will pointed out today, in Afghanistan, we've been there over twice as long as both World War I and II.
We're talking with Diana West. And Diana, in this piece that you wrote for your blog today, again found at dianawest.net, you point out that we can stay there, we can fight, and we can kill a lot of the Taliban and so forth, but we can't win because there's nothing to win. What did you mean by that?
Well, again, the strategy here is based on a notion that we can turn Afghanistan into an ally against what we call the war on terror or war on extremism, which is basically a way of talking about jihad, expansionist Islam, the spread of Sharia. And this is, again, related to the same failure to acknowledge the institutional and philosophical differences between our belief systems. There is no ally to emerge from an Afghanistan, or if we look at the case in Iraq, we do not have a country we can call an ally. Iraq, for example, is still a member of OPEC, still boycotting Israel, very sympathetic to Hezbollah, certainly not sympathetic to America's foreign policy aims in the world. And I see the same thing, the same techniques, the same strategies being taken to Afghanistan. I don't believe, no matter what we put into that country in terms of billions of dollars and flesh and blood, that we will emerge with anything like a friend. And this is part of our whole confusion, I believe. We look at the world rather in terms of fighting jihad and forming an anti-jihad coalition of countries that are already involved in fighting these same forces. And those would include, for example, India, which is not prominently mentioned in our coalition for a reason, because the Muslim nations have their own fight with the Hindu majority, India, Israel, Thailand, any number of countries along the border of Islam that are engaged in this sort of fight, Europe, which is deeply engaged in this fight, whether they know it or not, whether all of them know it or not. But rather, we try to incorporate pieces of the Islamic world that we think we can somehow persuade or buy or cajole into an alliance. And what we end up with is a messy situation, for example, with Pakistan, which seems like our soldiers can't turn their backs on Pakistani forces. You never know who they're colluding with. So this goes back to this same fundamental blindness, I would call it, in our way of looking at the world.
Diana, I have to imagine there are some people listening to this and thinking, well, wasn't the whole purpose of the war on terror to go out there and make sure that there's not a major safe haven like Afghanistan for the Taliban and al-Qaeda to plot and begin executing major terrorist attacks against the United States and other Western powers. How do we complete that mission if we're no longer there?
Well, this is where I, as a non-military person, defer to my military expert, which in this case I've discussed this with some military people, including retired General Paul Vallely, and his assessment of how to continue to fight, because I am not, like those on the left, interested in ceasing the fight. I think I would rather pursue it rather more aggressively than most of my conservative brethren. But the way that one would pursue this fight in regions such as Afghanistan and so on would be what General Vallely calls the maximum use of unconventional forces, which would include Navy SEALs and other special forces, which can be deployed from what he calls, and what I believe is known in military parlance, as lily pads, outposts or jumping off points from friendly countries and from friendly seas. This can be U.S. aircraft carrier strike groups, for example. This can be in countries like Israel, northern Kurdistan, India, Philippines, Italy. You know, we have a lot of resources at our disposal that have nothing to do with trying to put 50,000 men in an army base in Afghanistan. You know, the logistics alone are a nightmare and a very costly one. But the point is not to turn tail and surrender, which I think is usually the argument I hear from my conservative friends. I am not about that at all. I think that this strategy is actually that we have been deeply involved in for now eight years is something that if I were a jihadi, I would be thrilled with, because I think it only degrades, stretches, and demoralizes our military forces by giving them this impossible task and just expecting it to go on indefinitely. I mean, I am constantly amazed when I hear politicians and military officials discuss, oh, this will just go on for years, 5, 10, who knows how long we'll need to be there. It's madness, I believe. And there are faster, quicker, better, more decisive, and certainly more military-friendly ways to go about guarding us against the spread of Sharia and violence, the violence coming out of Islam, which is basically what this war is about if people would actually address it.
Last question before we let you go. Diana, in addition to a drastically different military strategy, the lily pad strategy, which you mentioned is advocated by General Vallely and some others, what other parts of a comprehensive strategy do you think would make sense in prosecuting this war? In other words, in terms of, you mentioned the hearts and minds and so forth, what else, if anything, is needed besides a much revised military strategy to make this a successful war?
Well, I think it needs to be considered in a more macro context, because this isn't all about just staving off outbursts of violence or instability in far-off countries. What we're seeing over the past decades is an expansion of Islam in general, not necessarily people throwing bombs, but people spreading Islamic law. And Islamic law is something that is absolutely antithetical to our notions of Western-style liberty, religious freedom, equality before the law, and so on, freedom of expression, freedom of conscience. So I believe a military strategy is one factor, but there has to be an adjustment in our immigration policies, because we are democracies, and I'm speaking of the West generally here. We are democracies, and if we get a demographic which favors Sharia law, well, by rights, our system would have to vote it in. And we're certainly seeing that occurring in Europe, where, for example, in England, there are already Sharia courts recognized by the British government that are functioning in family law. We are also seeing this same cultural shift going on. While I think we're a bit over-distracted by the military aspect, so I think there needs to be an enlargement of our understanding of what this era really is about, because we're seeing demographic changes, we're seeing civilizational changes that are really unprecedented, or at least haven't happened for quite several centuries anyhow, regarding the advance of Islam into the West. And I think it needs to be discussed and addressed and and rapidly, because you know these changes do get set into place and become very difficult to reverse. But you know, in terms of our alliance, for example, with Pakistan in trying to stem jihad, extremism, et cetera, you know, some recent numbers came out about attitudes in Pakistan that had 78% of Pakistanis favoring the death penalty for leaving Islam. Well, something like that is so foreign to our makeup, to our beliefs, that you think, how can our government even imagine fighting in alliance with a culture that has that sort of attitude? So I think we need to do some real rethinking, some real deep thinking, and try to figure out how to forge a more effective alliance against these threats.
Diana, unfortunately, our time is up. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Diana West, columnist in the Washington Examiner. Her blog is dianawest.net. Her book is The Death of the Grown-Up: How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.